Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Joining me here in the studio tonight is State Senator Scott Wiener. Senator Wiener represents District 11, including all of San Francisco, Broadmoor, Colma, Daly City, as well as part of South San Francisco. Elected just over a year ago, Senator Wiener has already made his mark in Sacramento by authoring 11 bills that were signed into law, including a landmark and controversial bill to increase the availability of affordable housing, as well as efforts to fund transportation infrastructure. He's also been at the forefront of state legislative efforts to resist the Trump administration. Prior to his election in the state Senate, Senator Wiener served as a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, where he authored a number of first-in-the-nation laws, such as requiring water recycling and solar power in new developments. Senator Wiener received his bachelor's degree from Duke University and his law degree from Harvard. He's lived in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood for over 20 years. Welcome, Senator Wiener.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you back on City Visions. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, and we'll open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So let me ask you, Senator Wiener, how exactly did you get your start in politics, and what made you want to jump into the fray?
Well, it's still a little bit unclear to me. No one in my family has ever been involved in politics before. I come from a very politically aware family, but it was a family of teachers and healthcare professionals, and no one who had been involved formally in politics. When I was 16 or 17, I started to intern for my member of Congress in New Jersey, and started volunteering on campaigns and kept going from there. I tried to get away from politics at a few points in my life, like when I moved to San Francisco 20 years ago, but I always got drawn back in. So eventually I realized that it was probably meant to be, and it's a passion for me.
And you just got elected a year ago, last November, to the state Senate, before that Board of Supervisors. How do you like working in Sacramento so far? Has it been as you would have expected, or does your approach to the issues differ now that you're on a statewide level rather than a local level?
It's amazing. I'm really enjoying it, and it's very, very different than being in local government. And I loved being on the Board of Supervisors. It was a terrific experience, and I was really passionate about it. And they're great in different ways. When you're in local government, you're with your constituents all the time. You are working hand in glove with the people you represent on projects in the community. You are just immersed, and that was terrific. It was very, very tangible. When you're renovating a park or getting more money for transit, it's very direct. In the Senate, you're a little more removed, and there are things that I miss about being so deeply entwined with the community. I'm away for a good part of the week in Sacramento. You're dealing with very high-level policy. But that is also really incredible in its own way, because when you are working on whether it's housing issues or nursing home issues or around homeless youth, whatever the case may be, you're impacting 40 million people. And particularly now with everything that's going on in the country and the fear that we all have, concerns we all have about what is happening, being in government in California is it's a blessing.
Well, I certainly want to get into some of those issues around what the state's doing in relation to now different federal administration and how that's playing out here on the ground. But just one last question for you around being in the state Senate now as opposed to being on the Board of Supervisors. What's been the most surprising aspect for you, the thing that you didn't expect coming into Sacramento?
I knew how diverse this state was, or I had a sense just from living here all these years. But it's even more diverse than I had realized. And it's not just a Bay Area, L.A. kind of diversity. It's the coast and inland. It's rural, urban, suburban. The racial diversity of our state is extraordinary and one of our real strengths. And, you know, among Democrats, you know, I was sometimes viewed as a quote-unquote more moderate Democrat in, on the Board of Supervisors. In the legislature, I'm one of the most progressive lefty members of the legislature, and working with actual moderate middle-of-the-road Democrats. And I had also never, in my political career, I had never worked with a Republican elected official before. It's San Francisco. Now I have, even though we have a two-thirds Democratic majority, I have Republican colleagues. And this was actually advice that my predecessor, Mark Leno, gave me, was don't just write off the Republicans on every bill. There's a diversity among the Republicans, and not every bill is a partisan issue. And so, I've really tried to work with all of my colleagues of both parties and find ways to work across the aisle where possible, and to show that we're not Congress. We're a little different.
And you mentioned the supermajority that Democrats have in both houses in the legislature. So you hear a lot about this phrase, a moderate Democratic caucus, or the moderate Dems who sort of occupy that critical middle there to get over the supermajority hump. How would you define the difference, or what are the issues that distinguishes a moderate Democrat, generally speaking, from a traditional or progressive Democrat?
It varies, and the Democrats that are classified or sometimes self-classify as moderate Democrats, who tend to be more from Central Valley, areas other than the very liberal coastal areas, they're not typically quote unquote moderate across the board. I have some colleagues, particularly in the Assembly, but also in the Senate, who they're very moderate, say on criminal justice issues, where they maybe vote more with law enforcement than I do or others do, but then on on issues around healthcare, they're extremely left. Members who will they don't like voting for tax increases, but they will vote for them, at least in some cases. It's very contextual. But I think criminal justice and public safety issues and somewhat divide the Democratic caucus, particularly since we have been very aggressive around criminal justice reform, trying to reduce and end mass incarceration, pursue alternatives to incarceration.
Well, let's get into some of those issues. I definitely want to talk about criminal justice reform, but housing is really, I think, where you've made your mark just in your first year here in the state Senate. And this year was supposedly the year of housing in the legislature. The legislature passed a record 15 bills aimed at trying to address various aspects of California's housing crisis. But your bill, SB 35, attempts to increase the availability of affordable housing in particular in our very unaffordable state by streamlining the approval process. Can you tell us a little bit about SB 35, how it came about, and what you set out to accomplish with it?
Sure. It was an exciting year for housing. I think traditionally housing has been viewed as a purely local concern in California, and I'm a supporter of local control. It's important, but it can't be an absolute kind of thing. And we've gotten ourselves into really, we've called it a crisis for a long time. It is really a disaster where people cannot afford housing. It's threatening the fabric of our communities, the diversity, threatening the future for young people. It's threatening our environment as people are pushed into long commutes with increased carbon emissions. And it undermines the economy because employers will not expand here if they don't think their workers can afford a home anywhere near where they work. So I went to Sacramento vowing to fight for housing. And fortunately, this year, there was a lot of energy around housing. And so we were able to produce a strong housing package, 15 bills, streamlining funding for low-income housing and other reforms. SB 35, it's a pretty simple concept. It basically says that when we say that there are housing goals for each city in the state, we mean it. We've been assigning housing goals to cities for a long time. That this is, you get every 8 years, every city gets a number for how many market rate units you're supposed to produce in the next 8 years, how many moderate income, low income, and very low income. And those, even though there are cities that try hard to meet those goals, many cities do not meet them or don't even try to meet them. And so SB 35 basically puts teeth into those goals by providing that for communities that are meeting housing that are on track to meet their housing goals, Godspeed. For communities that are not meeting their housing goals, you become streamlined. And what that means is that if someone comes along and proposes a project that is within the zoning that you've set, so you zoned this parcel for 50 units, someone proposes 50 units, you must approve it. You can't put them through a five-year process. You can't squish it down to 15 units. You have to approve it. You're really shortening the process and saying to cities that are not meeting their goals, we're going to help you meet your goals. The state is mixed in terms of some cities meet their market rate goals, others don't. But almost no one meets their below market rate goals. And the streamlining applies by income category. So if you're in a city that is meeting its market rate goals, like San Francisco currently is, but not meeting below market rate, you're streamlined only for below market rate. So the nonprofits that build affordable housing were among the strongest supporters of the bill because it will really tear down some barriers to getting that housing built.
And you just mentioned a supporter of the bill. What about those who opposed it? What kind of resistance did you get in pushing SB 35 through?
We had a broad coalition, the affordable housing, nonprofit developers. We had several major environmental organizations that supported the bill. Labor supported the bill. And so it was a really good coalition. Also, we had big city mayors. Most of the big city mayors supported it. The small and mid-sized cities opposed the bill. Not all of them, but a lot of them, including the League of California Cities, which really does not represent the interests of big cities, is much more dominated by small, mid-sized cities. They fought the bill on the principle of local control. And my view is that local control is about how you meet your housing goals, not whether you meet your housing goals. But that was really where the fight was.
And you mentioned that these projects still have to be consistent with local zoning. And that was some of the concerns I heard around the bill in the circles that I travel in the housing policy world, that this is stripping local control. But if they still have to be consistent with the zoning, how much is this bill really going to be getting at the issue to the extent that zoning is keeping new housing from getting built?
Right. It is. There's no silver bullet. There are a few different barriers to housing. One of them is the process. SB 35 gets at the process to say, okay, if you've zoned, then you have to honor that zoning, and you can't put people through an overly long process. Zoning is an issue, and it's a touchy one because that is really has always been the province of local control. But we are taking a look at making sure that zoning is not a barrier to addressing our crisis. So, for example, one thing we're looking at has to do with transit-oriented areas. So if you are around a major transit hub, but with super low-density housing, that's not sustainable. You want to have denser housing by transit-rich areas and transit hubs. And so we're looking at issues like that. But this package that we passed this year, 15 bills, I like to describe it as a healthy down payment. It is not by any stretch of the imagination the end. We're going to be doing more aggressive housing work next year, as I know will a number of my colleagues, and we have years of work ahead of us.
And so for those small and mid-sized cities that opposed it, since they still control their zoning, what do you think is the likelihood that some of these cities are just going to respond to this by making the housing production problem worse by downzoning and allowing even less development because now they're worried they're lost control of the discretionary review process?
A city is playing with fire if they downzone because there's a good chance that violates state law. There is state law which has not been well enforced in the past, but I believe it will be enforced as of now and going forward. The cities are required to adopt housing elements where they designate where they're going to put their housing. And in the past, some of them have played a game where they designate areas for housing with no intent of putting housing there. Well, now they have to put the housing there. And if they go in and start deleting sites as housing and doing downzoning, they can get sued. They can get sued by the state. They can get sued by individuals. We actually, as part of this package, we empowered the Attorney General to bring lawsuits. We also made it easier for individuals and organizations to sue cities who are doing things like arbitrarily denying projects, arbitrarily downzoning. And I think that a lot of times cities will do the right thing. Berkeley was considering significant downzoning a few months back. Some would argue to avoid the impending state housing legislation. And there was a lot of organizing against that, and the city backed off. There's been a fight in Cupertino about a particular site, and the council backed off and it's taking more time. So I don't believe we're going to see a lot of downzoning.
Mm-hmm. So last question on SB 35. So another question is, the bill also contains a prevailing wage requirement, which I think was part of the getting the labor unions to be on board with it. But given that there is a prevailing wage, that these projects have to have that type of labor agreement, and we've got a lot of markets around the state where that's just not going to pencil out. These projects aren't going to pencil out with that. In reality, how much application do you think SB 35 is really going to have in the real world? And I mean, are we really going to see projects that are going to come about, and to what extent with these kinds of additional requirements?
Absolutely, we will. So yes, there is a prevailing wage requirement. We want construction jobs that don't pay people poverty wages, and so that was important. The way it works is prevailing wage is triggered at 11 units. So if someone's building a project, and it doesn't apply to single family homes because we want to encourage multi-unit. So anywhere from 2 up to 10 units. So any project up to 10 units, no prevailing wage is required. And if you look at the kind of housing that multi-unit that tends to get built around California, yes, there are big projects. There are a lot of projects that get built at 10 units and under, and there will be no prevailing wage at that. And it's also, it scales up depending on the size of the project. Prevailing wage does not pencil out in every community, but it pencils out in quite a few, and particularly in the more expensive coastal areas, which is where we have the worst crisis. So if it doesn't pencil out, say like in a Bakersfield or in a Redding, I would argue that the housing crisis, even though it is spreading inland, it is not just a coastal issue, it is less acute inland than it is in the over-the-top housing markets along the coast, where prevailing wage is much more likely to pencil out in the Bay Area, in the most expensive parts of LA, where we need more housing, and where historically, you know, housing in the Bay Area has been much more obstructed than it has been in the Central Valley. So in the end, I think it'll come out in the wash, and I'm glad that we have it in there.
I want to ask you about another issue related to housing that is near and dear to many San Franciscans' heart, is public transportation. And as a San Francisco supervisor, you authored a ballot measure that tied public transportation funding to population growth. Will you be pushing for something similar, legislation like that, at the state level?
The state has really been, up until this year, I would argue, derelict in terms of funding transit other than high-speed rail, which I strongly support, but it's not enough. The state has to do more, and particularly with the federal government pulling back, we have to step up as a state. So this year we passed SB1, a $5.2 billion annual transportation funding measure, the largest transportation funding measure in the history of California, and almost 20% of those funds, almost $1 billion a year, will go as new money for public transportation. The rest is for city streets, freeways, and bridges. So that was a step forward, and I joined a few other of my colleagues, and we fought to increase the amount that would go to public transportation, because originally it was smaller. So it was a good result. We also authorized the Bay Area. We passed a bill, I'm forgetting the bill number, that authorizes the Bay Area to go to the ballot with what we'll call Regional Measure 3. It will increase the tolls on all of the Bay Area bridges other than the Golden Gate Bridge, and the money will go to both bridge maintenance, but largely to public transportation. So we are, I think we had a productive year for transit. I want to see the state do more. We have more work to do. And the Bay Area and LA are both being quite aggressive in terms of transit funding. But with the growth that we're seeing, the Bay Area has 2 million more people than it did in the 80s. We're going to grow by a few million more. We can't have another 800,000, a million cars on the roads of the Bay Area. We have to give better transit options. We need to dramatically shore up and expand the capacity of BART, of Muni, of Caltrain. We're doing that. Caltrain is fully funded for its modernization electrification program, which will significantly increase the speeds, the frequency, and the capacity of that system. BART, we passed a bond. There's other money coming in. That entire fleet is going to be changed out. BART will be more reliable. And Muni is gradually basically replacing its entire fleet and all of its infrastructure. But we have more work to do, and particularly the Muni subway continues to be a mess, and we need to get that together.
Well, I'm sure some of our listeners will have questions around that. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight, we're talking with State Senator Scott Wiener, representing San Francisco and communities to the south. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you impacted by California's housing crisis? Do you think the legislation that we just talked about and some of the others that were recently signed into law will make a difference? Do you have questions or concerns about the construction of affordable housing projects in your neighborhood? Or do you have questions about other issues, which I hope to get to, like public transportation, clean energy, homelessness, health care, or issues facing the LGBT community? Please bring us your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website at kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, we have an email in from Leora, who asks about housing close to BART stations. And Leora says there are a few proposals for housing close to BART that have met community opposition. We've invested billions of dollars in these transit stations, and we can't get enough ridership without having housing nearby. How can we get affordable housing projects near BART stations built?
I could not agree more, and it's music to my ears to hear that question. When I was in local government, I was on a regional transportation commission, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. I one time made some comments about my frustration that there were BART stations and Caltrain stations surrounded by single-family home zoning, and that should change. I got a lot of heat for saying that. I don't think the cities should be requiring that only low density buildings be built around transit stations. We should have infill, multi-unit dense housing around these stations, it makes sense for so many reasons. You want to have people be able to walk to transit. It's exactly where you want to put new housing. If you put only single-family homes around these transit stations, then all you're doing is pushing people out further and further so they have to drive.
So do you see any plans in the legislature to address this issue around housing around transit stations?
I'm looking at it.
All right. Well, you heard it here maybe first. I don't know, but maybe you did. I want to ask about another issue, cannabis regulation, because you made some headlines recently about that, where you expressed concern about proposals before the San Francisco Board of Supervisors that might expand the proposed barrier from selling cannabis around schools from 600 feet to 1,000 feet and include child care centers as part of that exclusion, which would cover almost all of the city. So what do you say to people who are concerned about cannabis operations opening up near schools?
I've tried really hard this year. I left the Board of Supervisors last December, and I've tried not to inject myself into every issue. Believe me, I read the papers and I see what's going on. I have opinions, but I didn't want to be that guy who was always, the grumpy guy saying everything you're doing is wrong. And if I were still there, it would be right. So I've tried to steer clear. But when I saw What was happening with cannabis, it looked to me like a slow-moving train wreck in terms of a number of different restrictions that my former colleagues were considering that when you combine them together would effectively ban new cannabis businesses in San Francisco. And so I did feel the need to speak out, and I joined with my former colleague, Supervisor David Campos, to speak out together. We don't always agree, but we do agree on this. I do think the board is moving in a more positive direction now. I've spoken with some of my former colleagues, and I know that they really want to get it right. The state recommends a radius around K through 12 schools of 600 feet, which is more than a block. The idea of going beyond that to 1,000 feet or including child care centers, would wipe cannabis out of San Francisco. I'm sensitive to not putting it too close to schools, particularly when you talk about older elementary school kids, middle school, high school, where a kid can wander off. In terms of child care, the idea that a three-year-old who is supervised 24 hours a day is going to wander off and into a cannabis dispensary, that doesn't make sense to me. And if that happened to randomly happen, I have a feeling that that cannabis dispensary, rather than selling to the three-year-old, would probably be calling to the police saying a three-year-old just wandered in. The reality is that 74% of San Franciscans voted to legalize cannabis. It is legal. San Francisco should be welcoming this industry. It is an innovative industry. It creates blue-collar jobs, which we are missing in the city. It generates tax revenue. At times, Reefer Madness, that movie from the 1930s about how cannabis just destroys everything, that Reefer Madness is descending in some quarters in San Francisco. And I hear comparisons of cannabis to heroin and to meth, and that's just not accurate.
Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have a question on this topic of cannabis. So Ken from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, good evening. Thank you. I'm a medical cannabis patient of more than a dozen years, back to when the city issued its own card and did so very well through the Department of Public Health. A few really quick things on this. One, as a medical cannabis patient with a doctor's recommendation, I don't think we should be taxed. Big pharma going into Walgreens, your medication isn't taxed. This shouldn't be taxed. Recreational use is another matter. Too many places view cannabis as a cow to be milked, which means taxing the crap out of it. I understand they want their money, but please, distinction must be made as a medication. Second thing is that I ran into in one of the dispensaries, and I know of two others that do it, is they actually copy identification records, including driver's licenses, doctor's recommendations, etc. And in the event of a raid by the feds, they consider that basically evidence of drug sales. So I think HIPAA rules, the protected health information rules, should apply to cannabis buyers. And the last thing is, if cannabis, I'm kind of stunned at the news that the Board of Supes in the city seems like they're just addressing the legalization of cannabis and trying to figure it out now, and they've had all this time. Unbelievable. And if it's such a problem, why not limit it to San Francisco residents in the city of San Francisco? Other localities could do that till they really have a handle on it, because I'm kind of stunned at the disorganization and the arguments over these ridiculous footage rules, when the kids probably see more booze and cigarette ads than cannabis.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. No, a lot of interesting questions there around cannabis usage, Senator Wiener.
So in terms of taxation, the ballot measure that the people of California passed last November imposes a 15% excise tax on adult-use cannabis sales. I agree with you, there should be a distinction between medicinal and adult use. In terms of the Board of Supervisors, whenever a potentially challenging issue comes up, there's a tendency to put it off until you absolutely have to deal with it. And this is politically, for a number of reasons, has become a challenging one at City Hall in terms of the land use regulations for cannabis, because there are a lot of there are people who support legalizing cannabis, but they just don't want it anywhere near their house. I did author 2 years ago legislation to create a cannabis state legalization task force. We passed that legislation at the Board of Supervisors. We then went through a whole process and appointed 15 or 20 people to be on this blue ribbon task force. That task force spent a year studying the issue, and the whole goal was to prepare well in advance for legalization, to make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors to avoid a fire drill. Those recommendations were made at the beginning of this year. Unfortunately, we now have a fire drill. That is what it is, and we just need to make sure at this point that we have reasonable restrictions and regulations in place.
And do you see any really likely legislation at the state level next year regarding legal cannabis?
I think there will always be legislation or bills in the legislature around cannabis every year for years and years and years. The governor has been, I think, very insistent that cannabis regulation not be done in an ad hoc way. This year it was done through the budget, and so a number of us had bills. I had a bill around cannabis businesses who pay their taxes in cash because they can't bank under federal law, trying to make it easier for them. And it got swept into the budget. And I think we're going to see some coordinated efforts at the state level.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking with State Senator Scott Wiener, representing San Francisco, the entire city, and some communities to the south. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with your questions at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to the phone lines to Damien from Vallejo. Damien, welcome to City Visions.
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on the air. What's your question for Senator Wiener?
First, Senator Wiener, I really appreciate all the work you're doing, and it sounds like you really got a good head on your shoulder.
Thank you.
I have actually is more of a complaint. I'm a commuter. I commute every day from Vallejo to San Rafael, and I am sometimes double charged on bridges if I can't go through 37. And you've increased the gasoline tax by 12 cents, thereby increasing my cost, as well as now you're talking about increasing the toll, thereby increasing even more costs. And so my complaint is, why are you taxing the very people that you're supposed to be helping? And second, if all this money is coming into California Treasury, where the hell is it going that you have to again tax us?
Well, let's talk about taxes and fees related to cars. And I say this, I'm a driver. I have a car. I pay the same gas tax and the same tolls, same vehicle registration fees that you and others pay. In California, and we did the transportation funding measure I mentioned earlier, consists of an increase of 12 cents to the gas tax, as well as a modest increase to the vehicle registration fee in California. California's gas tax, like the federal gas tax, had not been raised in 25 years, even for inflation. So the gas tax, again, before this went into effect about a month ago in California, was the same as it was in the early 1990s. And that is true of the federal gas tax as well. So because of that, both the California and federal gas tax in real dollars, because of no inflation adjustment, it was worth about half of what it was 25 years before. And so that is a problem in and of itself. The idea that we're simply jacking up the gas tax is really not accurate. We're trying to make up for what should have been happening all along in terms of at least keeping pace with inflation. In addition, we all pay a vehicle license fee if we are a driver. That fee for 50 years was 2% of the value of the car, which made a lot of sense. If you're driving a Mercedes SUV, you're going to pay a heck of a lot more than someone who's driving a 20-year-old Dodge. Arnold Schwarzenegger, after he got into office on the recall, slashed that vehicle license fee by two-thirds, from 2% down to 0.65%, depriving the state of about $4 or $5 billion a year, year in and year out. So as a driver, I can tell you that I am paying only one-third of what I used to pay for my vehicle license fee, and my federal and state gas tax in real dollars have continually gone down. So as a driver, I don't mind paying the extra 12 cents per gallon or paying more in bridge tolls so that we can fix the roads. The reality is that our roads in California, city streets are falling apart. Our freeways are falling apart. Our public transportation systems are old. We want to get more people on the transit, and we're only going to do that if we pay for it. And these funds are lockboxed. There's a constitutional amendment that we put on the ballot for next year to say that these funds can only be used for these purposes, and the legislature will never be able to change that.
So thank you, Damian, for that question. And, you know, I was teeing off of what Damian asked. Some of the critics say, you know, we're already spending a lot of money on transportation. What is the state doing to make sure that that money is being spent as cost effectively as possible? I mean, I see some of the numbers related to just transit, which I know is an important issue to you. How much we spend here in the U.S., you know, if not California, per mile, even compared to other developed nations with strong labor laws and all those protections that we would, you know, probably value here in California, at least among the majority. But they're able to get a lot of these projects built a lot cheaper, a lot faster. What's going on in terms of the oversight of how the existing dollars are being spent?
There have been issues, but in this funding bill, we also put some streamlining measures in place to try to get the projects delivered more cost effectively. So we are aware that we need to do better in terms of how we deliver these projects. But there are good things happening. When you look at some of the transit improvements that are happening here, also in L.A., there's a lot of good things happening. We just have to keep up the momentum. But we can always do better, and the state in particular needs to be more efficient in how we spend transportation dollars.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about another issue that you've really been leading on, youth homelessness. And I know you're particularly concerned about this. You chair the Senate Human Services Committee, which held a joint meeting with the State Assembly Human Services Committee in Los Angeles in late September and heard testimony from a variety of experts, informally homeless youth. Wanted to find out from you what you learned and kind of what your plans are to try to address youth homelessness going forward.
Sure. When I was on the Board of Supervisors, this was an issue that I did a lot of work on, particularly to try to get funds into the Castro Upper Market area where I represented to get more transitional housing for homeless youth, health programs, meal programs, and so forth. It's a tragedy when anyone is living on our streets, but particularly when you have young people, whether they have run away from home, whether they came to San Francisco thinking they would find a place that they could afford, and all of a sudden they're couch surfing or living on the streets, and people who have other issues around substance abuse or mental health problems. And these young people, we know that if you can get a homeless young person off the streets quickly, you have a shot at getting them on the right path. If they spend 5-10 years and all of a sudden they're 30, 35, long-term homeless, it becomes much, much harder. So it behooves us to try to help these kids. We also know that statistically, and this is recent data that is so disturbing, CSU reports that 1 out of 10 CSU students is homeless in California. And there was a national report that just came out, which is just horrendous, that of youth, the entire country, young people age 18 to 24, in any given year, 1 out of 10 will experience homelessness at some point. And for youth age 13 to 17, 1 out of 30 will experience homelessness at some point in any given year. That is unacceptable. So we did hold this oversight hearing to gather information. And as we announced at the conclusion of the hearing, my counterpart, the chair of the Assembly Human Services Committee, and I are going to pursue a bill next year to try to have the state be much more coordinated about how it delivers services for homeless youth. You can't just lump homeless youth in with all homeless. They have very unique needs. And also to increase the state's investment in our homeless youth. Up until before last year, the state of California was spending a whopping $1 million statewide for all homeless youth focused services. That has gone up, but it's still not enough, and we have to help these kids.
When you mentioned services, what about building housing and providing funding for it?
Yeah, that, when I say services, I include housing in there. Yes, and you know, there's permanent housing, but also transitional housing. There's a wonderful organization in San Francisco called Larkin Street Youth Services, which provides transitional housing to get these young people stable, get them, whether it's, you know, trained for work or into school, and give them plenty of time, but with the hope being that they'll transition out to a more stable life, and then other kids will be able to come off the streets into that transitional housing.
And a couple other bills passed this year, SB 2, SB 3, which provide additional dollars for affordable housing. So one of those is a real estate document fee. The other is a bond measure, which is going to go before the voters for approval. Will that help address this this challenge? And more broadly, what do you think are the potential impacts of SB 2 and SB 3 for affordable housing?
Yeah, so as part of the housing package that I mentioned that we discussed earlier, two of the bills provide funding for affordable housing. SB 2 will generate about $250 million a year from a fee on certain real estate transactions. And then SB 3 is a bond that you'll see on the ballot next year that will generate $4 billion for affordable housing. There obviously will be a lot of pulls on that money because the need is so great, but housing for homeless youth is certainly one of the categories that will be funded.
And I guess a repeal of that gas tax measure that that Damian was calling about, that's on the ballot as well?
Yes. There are people who are fighting to repeal our transportation funding measure, which will then withdraw $5.2 billion of transportation investment per year for the state of California.
Mm-hmm. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking with State Senator Scott Wiener. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. If you have questions about issues that we've been talking about, like public transportation, homelessness, health care, issues facing the LGBT community, we want to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, we have an email question from Daria who asks about, what about disappearing farmland? Residential housing has swallowed up a huge amount of formerly agricultural land, Daria writes, and young farmers are having trouble finding land. There's just an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about this. Is preservation of our agricultural resources factoring into the housing discussion in the legislature?
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. This is what happens when you have cities like, for example, in the Bay Area or other coastal areas that refuse to build enough housing. And all it does is it pushes people out and you have sprawl. And sprawl, you know, means that you're covering up often farmland. And that's not healthy for California for the reasons I stated before, but also for our agricultural economy. And so that is a focus. In SB 35, my housing streamlining bill, it only applies to infill housing, and it specifically excludes things like prime farmland. So there is a sensitivity in the legislature to try to move away from having sprawl and covering up open space and farmland and focusing on dense urban infill housing near transit, because that's where we should be building the housing.
Mm-hmm. And I have to ask you another question on a different topic, and this is about something you mentioned earlier about the changed federal landscape here that California finds itself with the election of Trump the same night that you were elected to the state Senate. And
that's a fun way to celebrate your victory.
Yeah, it must have been a little bit of a bittersweet feeling for you given your political leanings. So you have co-authored some legislation, taken some leadership role in trying to resist the Trump administration efforts and really position California California for greater sovereignty and sort of control over its domestic policies that the Trump administration may try to undo. And one of the pieces of legislation that you authored would have required presidential candidates on the California ballot to release their tax returns for the previous 5 years. The governor vetoed it. I know that he himself did not disclose his tax returns. Can you explain a little bit about what his concerns were in vetoing the bill that had passed both houses of the legislature that would have required President Trump, when he's on the – assuming he's on the ballot again in 2020, he would have had to disclose his tax returns to get the California electoral votes, right?
Yeah, I think that's a bill that I co-authored with my terrific colleague to the north, Senator Mike McGuire, who represents the Golden Gate Bridge up to the Oregon border. And we worked really hard on that bill, and I think it's a good bill. We all took for granted that if you run for president, you disclose your tax returns. And no one thought twice about it because it always happened until, this person comes along and just brazenly refuses to disclose anything. And so I think we realized that there was sort of a loophole and we needed to close that loophole. And this bill did that. It was a good bill. We passed it out of the legislature. Our Republican colleagues fought us on it every step of the way. But it's really not a partisan issue. It applies to all presidential candidates. The governor vetoed it. I have enormous respect for the governor. This is the only bill of mine that got vetoed. So I'm really grateful that the governor signed a lot of important bills, but we just have a difference of opinion. There are some people who say that the bill was unconstitutional. I don't think that's correct. We have very credible legal scholars who say that the bill is quite legal, but we had a difference of opinion with the governor. There will be a new governor in January of 2019, and if we pass it in 2019, we'll have enough time to have it apply to the 2020 election.
Although I suppose President Trump, if he's running again, might say, I don't care if I get the California electoral votes, right? He could it could not necessarily get the outcome that you want, at least for this upcoming cycle.
Right. Well, it applies in the primary. That's where the bill focuses. And I don't know. I mean, I have to think that he's going to have a primary challenge. And I don't think, when you've acted as in such an unstable, frankly, sociopathic manner as he's acted, he better not take anything for granted because people are awake to what he's doing.
And what do you make of the governor's concerns in vetoing that bill, that this is a slippery slope, that what's to stop all sorts of requirements being added to the presidential election at the state level?
I respectfully disagree with the governor on that point. It's not, I'm not aware of any other proposals to add more requirements. And all this is it's an administrative requirements similar to filling out paperwork or paying a fee that we already require of candidates. And it's administrative, and I don't think it would have undermined anything or anyone. I hope that we are eventually able to get this passed.
And so what else is the state doing to resist the Trump administration? What else legislatively do you think is important for listeners to know happened in this past legislative session and also upcoming?
Yeah, a few things. First of all, we have really stepped up to defend our immigrant neighbors. We know that immigrants make California and our country a better place, and it's really just despicable what this administration has been doing around immigration. Most recently, the announcement that 59,000 Haitians who came here to escape disaster are going to be unceremoniously deported. People who are overwhelmingly employed, who have mortgages on homes, who are raising their children here, and for no reason other than animus are going to be kicked out. So we're going the other way in California. We passed SB 54, which basically provides that California is not going to be part of Donald Trump's deportation machine, and that we are not going to enforce his approach to federal immigration law. And we're not required to enforce federal law, and we don't want our law enforcement acting as immigration officers. We want immigrants to trust law enforcement and to trust that if they go and report a crime or go serve as a witness, that's not going to get them deported. I have a bill, SB 785, that seeks to protect immigrants who are testifying in court. We have situations now where an immigrant will go to court to testify as a victim of crime, as a witness, and the attorney on the other side will cross-examine them and say, well, what's your immigration status? Are you really trying to get a crime victim visa, even though they have no basis to ask the question? So we're going to require that they first have to make a proffer to a showing to the judge that it's relevant. They can't just blurt it out in court because that intimidates witnesses. We are really trying to stand firm around women's health and women's access to all healthcare, including reproductive health. And so we have been real clear that we're going to support Planned Parenthood and support access to contraception, for example. And we're standing up for LGBT people, my community, and particularly for our transgender brothers and sisters, that as this administration picks on trans children by classifying them as predators if they, heaven forbid, use the restroom that corresponds to their gender identity. Administration that's trying to kick trans soldiers out, people who are putting their lives at risk for our country. It's just really horrible actions. We passed legislation to make it much easier for trans people to correct their genders on government documents, and also allows people to identify as non-binary.
So lots of action here in California to resist some of the Trump administration policies. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking with State Senator Scott Wiener. If you live in San Francisco, he is your state senator, and some of the communities just to the south of San Francisco as well. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. We have just about 10 minutes left. The phone lines are open. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Senator Wiener, you talked about a lot of these steps you've taken to resist the Trump administration, and it's raised the hackles of conservatives. Have you been surprised by some of the pushback that you've gotten?
It is, in the era of social media, it's extraordinary. I mean, I've been the subject of right-wing ire before. A few years ago, when Fox News had descended on San Francisco around the terrible Kate Steinle shooting tragedy, and used it as an opportunity to attack immigrants overall and San Francisco's status as a sanctuary city. I had a little encounter with a Fox News reporter where he tried to interview me and I refused to be interviewed and told him that Fox News is not real news. And that went a little viral and we had to turn off our phone lines in the office because the vitriol that was being directed towards us. The Make America Great Again Internet trolls they're all over my Twitter feed in particular. They went after me for a bill I authored to decriminalize HIV. We repealed some felonies that single out HIV for uniquely harsh criminal treatment. These are terrible, unfair laws that targeted really poor people. And so we repealed those laws. Breitbart and Fox News and others went after me hard. And these trolls come out of the woodwork and post swastikas on my feed and make homophobic and anti-Semitic remarks. They also went after me for my bill to create legal protections for LGBT seniors who are living in long-term care facilities, and to make sure that they're treated with respect and dignity that they have earned. And they basically, Breitbart and Fox turned it into a trans restroom issue that some frail trans senior in a nursing home is somehow a threat to other people. And so they went after me on that as well. So, I view it, if Breitbart and Fox News and the the Trump trolls are going after you, you must be doing something right.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about the abuse that you've gotten on social media. Unfortunately, it's just all too easy, I think, in this day and age for that to happen. I want to ask about a couple other issues related to the environment. One is solar power. You had authored legislation, as we mentioned, to require solar power new developments. Do you new housing developments. Do you see something like that coming up at the state level?
Well, I do have a bill that is still pending, SB 71, that would take the rooftop solar mandate statewide. That bill is not we've had some struggles with it. So I think we're going to be taking a different approach to expand solar. We have another idea. I'm not prepared to disclose it yet, that we're going to pursue starting in January, that I think will actually be even more impactful. So we're really excited about that because we need to get to 100% clean energy in California. We need to decarbonize our economy, move away from fossil fuels, and that's through rooftop, through transformation, electrification of our transportation system, and so forth. I do have another bill that will make it more affordable for property owners, homeowners, to put energy storage systems on their homes, on their buildings. Right now, if you have solar panels, we have a problem or a challenge where they'll produce a lot of solar energy when most people aren't home during the day, and then not any when people are home at night. And so you have an imbalance, which means a lot of energy flows into the grid during the day, and then people are withdrawing a lot of power at night, which cause problems. And so what we want is for people who have solar panels to be able to have an energy storage system in their home, some sort of battery, so that when they're not there, lots of sun, you store the energy, and then you tap into it at night. The systems are expensive. And so this will be a rebate program to help people afford these systems and to really spur the innovation in this industry.
And then I also want to ask you real quickly about recycling. You've tried to reform California's recycling program, and you've gotten legislation, SB 458, to authorize 5 mobile recycling pilot programs. Can you describe a little bit about what these programs are meant to do?
Sure. So our recycling laws, the so-called bottle bill, it needs a lot of reform because it needs to be modernized. A lot has changed since it was adopted decades ago. That's a bigger project that hopefully will happen at some point soon. The mobile recycling bill that I authored was designed to address a problem that we thought only existed in San Francisco, but turns out exists elsewhere, that recycling centers are closing down because of the economics of the industry, land values, and so forth. And in San Francisco, we've gone from, I believe, 34 recycling centers to 7. We lost 80% of our recycling centers. What that means is if you are, a grocery store, including a small mom and pop, and if you don't have a recycling center within a half a mile, you're required to accept recycling redemption, which is a huge burden for these small businesses in particular. So this bill will allow San Francisco and other cities to set up a pilot program with mobile recycling where you have different, either a reverse vending machine or a vehicle that goes around the city on a set schedule to accept recycling, and that will relieve these grocery stores of the obligation to accept recycling redemption.
All right, so something to look out for on the streets around San Francisco. So we've got just a little less than a minute left. What do you see as the big issues to look forward to in 2018 legislatively in Sacramento and maybe federally as well?
Well, in Sacramento, we're going to take another hard run at housing next year because our work isn't done, and we're going to push clean energy legislation as well. We're going to do, I think, some really good work next year. I think it'll be another productive session. And then we have to play defense federally. We have to stop this tax bill, which is horrendous. We have to, keep the Affordable Care Act intact, and we need a better Congress.
All right. Well, on that note, that's City Visions for this evening. My guest was State Senator Scott Wiener. Thank you, Scott, so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join us next week on City Visions, next Monday, as always, where we'll discuss the intersection of pro football, politics and culture with City Vision's co-host Joseph Pace. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.